Next up, Will Boyd. Thanks for joining us this evening. Will and his wife have six sons and two daughters and have lived in Latah County for 21 years. He grew up in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia and earned a BS in biology and minors in chemistry and conservation biology from the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point in 2000. He earned a Master of Science in Natural Resources and Secondary Science Teaching Endorsement from the University of Idaho in 2013. Will founded the Homeschool Institute of Science in 2013 and has been teaching science to children ages 4 through 24 for 25 years. He's an avid birder, has set foot in every ocean, and is currently obsessed with the marine intertidal zone. And his talk this evening is entitled, We Are Not Beavers, The Cost of Creating Slack Water. Thank you, Will.
Thanks, Jeremy. Pleased to be here this evening. And first a question for you all. Have you ever heard a beaver slap water with its tail? It is a shocking sound. Sounds like a bullet ringing out through the air. And so this slide reminded me of a time in Canada hearing that sound and not knowing what it was at first, and then discovering the beaver that was warning me to get away. So with that little tale here, let's get going. As Jeremy said, my title for the talk is We Are Not Beavers, The Cost of Creating Slack Water. The free-running Snake and Clearwater Rivers once provided significant natural assets to mankind. Beauty, clean cold water, fish, recreation, transportation, inspiration, waterfowl, solace, among many others. Many of these assets are now compromised. Since the four lower Snake River dams were completed in 1976, return rates for salmon to Lower Granite Lock and Dam have consistently fallen below 2%. Dam construction transformed the free-flowing Snake into a series of slackwater lakes, running over 100 miles from the Tri-Cities, Washington, to Lewiston, Idaho. The low flow, increased water temperature, and high nutrient load in these lakes significantly limit juvenile salmon's ability to migrate to sea and mature salmon's ability to spawn. Snake River salmon and steelhead currently require significant ecological subsidy to prevent complete failure. Removal of the four lower Snake River dams and select others, including Dwarshak, would restore these natural assets and eliminate the need for billions of taxpayer dollars earmarked for salmon restoration and dam maintenance annually. I hope to present a cogent case for this seemingly drastic action by introducing some ecological concepts, unpacking the recent history of the Snake River and its second largest tributary, the Clearwater, connecting ecology and economics a little bit with some help from you guys afterwards, and making the case that this fits well within the Christian's work to replenish the earth and subdue it, Genesis 1:28. Beavers are well-known and well-admired creatures. These large semi-aquatic rodents have come to symbolize industriousness and resourcefulness. I will be using beavers tonight to illustrate beneficial alteration of creation. Beavers' superpower is their ability to transform habitat. There are few creatures on the planet that can do it as effectively. In addition to beavers, prairie dogs, elephants, corals, oysters, and a few other animals can cause landscape-level changes. Organisms with this capacity have been informally called ecosystem engineers and officially dubbed keystone species by ecologists for their ability to create new niches. Yes, it's pronounced niche, my millennial friends out there. Ornithologist Joseph Grinnell coined the term in 1917. Eugene Odom, considered by many the father of modern ecology, popularized the term in the mid-20th century and defined it as an organism's address and occupation. A beaver's niche is fairly broad and obvious. A stream or other type of wetland is its address, and its occupation is creating slack water by building dams. So beavers alter habitat by creating slack water. They transform stretches of creeks and rivers into relatively still pools by building dams from trees. This has the remarkable effect of making homes for many plants and animals that would not otherwise colonize the area. Beavers' work increases biodiversity. This is unusual, at least to us. We should think about habitat alteration or any landscape change or manipulation in economic terms. There are costs and there are benefits. The cost that an ecosystem accrues when a beaver creates slack water is low. The benefits are high. Flow of a stream might temporarily be reduced, but the beaver's work does not impede the water cycle, the nutrient cycle, or growth of animal and plant populations. Beavers create temporary ponds which provide new niches for pond-loving creatures that require more warmth, less oxygen, more organic matter, and lower flow rates. Additionally, beaver dams are temporary and easily undone. Undone by storms or by irritated landowners. Because a beaver dam is temporary and relatively small in scale, they tend to not cause the eviction of former tenants. A beaver dam might slow the movement of an anadromous fish species, one that lives at sea and spawns in freshwater, for a few years on one small creek, but it does not alter watershed scale processes. In fact, salmon often find new suitable habitat for rearing young where beavers have been busy at work. Beavers can flood a trail and kill an aspen stand, but their impact on the whole adds to the biodiversity and the dynamic nature of riparian ecosystems. Man, in ecological terms, is a hyperkeystone species. That's an actual term. Hyperkeystone species, according to ecologists Boris Worm and Robert Payne, who coined the phrase less than 10 years ago, are capable of driving complex interaction chains by affecting other keystone species across diverse habitats. We can alter nearly everything. We can eliminate entire fish runs. We can turn whitewater into a stagnant reservoir thousands of square miles in size. We can move elephants from the wilds of Malawi to zoos in metropolitan Europe. We can hold a weekend derby and snipe all the prairie dogs in South Dakota. A couple of you like that idea. I saw it. We can also do great magnanimous things, like ban whaling or restore mangrove ecosystems, which effectively grow the shoreline outward by collecting sediment. And point in case here, if you want land to accrue value, buy coastal ecosystems and plant mangroves. You're going to gain acres annually. Hot tip, right? Okay. Of course, I lost my place by going there. There we go. A few more ecological terms and graphics to get us started, and I realized, there we go, just in time. One mistake many early ecologists made was to separate man from his ecosystem. Man was implicitly deemed unnatural and seen as an antagonist to native ecosystems. Any good economist sees the problem with excluding the hyperkeystone species from any type of ecological accounting. This view is fading, thankfully. Here's an image of a food web with us included, and that's hard to find. Still, a food web is a more holistic tool than a food chain, as it shows more components of a community, as well as movement in multiple directions. Food webs show feeding relationships in a community. Food webs can get incredibly complex if all creatures, including invertebrates and microbes, are added. Here are a couple other Pacific Northwest food webs. There's a simple one including salmon, much like we might see on the Clearwater or snake. And they can get even way more complex than this. The last ecological concept and graphic I'd like to show you is called a food or energy pyramid. This type of illustration can be used to show trophic levels, predator-prey decomposer, where a creature feeds or what they feed on. It can include actual population numbers, biomass, and or energy flow, among others. Notice that the smallest organisms have the greatest population sizes. So primary producers would be primarily photosynthetic organisms like algae or plants. Jeremy Bunch recently did an excellent job introducing the problems facing terrestrial ecosystems, mainly the degrading and loss of our soil, in his talk, Burning the Land Slowly. I highly recommend it. As my topic of consideration is the economics and ecology of dams, I consider this an attempt to complement his work with an aquatic analog. As the Earth is a unified whole created by our perfect creator in a wonderfully consistent and orderly fashion, there should be plenty of overlap. 71% of the Earth's surface is covered by ocean. As the late, great Arthur C. Clarke put it, how inappropriate to call this planet Earth when it is quite clearly ocean. You can debate that one during the Q&A. The world's ocean, they are connected after all, is fed by rivers large and small, including our own mighty Columbia, which is fed by the Snake, which is fed by the Clearwater, which is fed by the Potlatch, and so on. So rivers feed oceans with water, but there's feeding the other direction. In the other direction, these rivers are fed by anadromous fish, including salmon, steelhead, lamprey, and the mighty sturgeon. These fish fatten up at sea, swim home, spawn, and depending on several factors, die and contribute their nutrients to cold upstream nutrient-poor waters. Nutrient-poor cold waters characterize much of the Intermountain West. Cold, dry climates are not conducive to decomposition. Plants and animals die and then have a relatively short window of time to decompose before they are frozen annually for 4 to 8 months. Therefore, the nutrients brought upstream from the ocean to the forests and fields are absolutely essential. The lion's share of these nutrients have historically been carried upstream by salmon and steelhead. As salmon, the mighty icons of the North Pacific, have been harmed significantly by dam construction on the Columbia River system, I can't tell the story or make the case without including a fair bit about them. But I'm not obsessed with salmon. I want to make this point really clear. There are so many creatures involved in a river ecosystem. It just so happens that salmon are iconic, that are the most important economically, they're most important culturally. That's why I'm doing the deep dive on salmon. We could do a deep dive on any of the creatures in the Columbia, but this is going to be the most effective, I think. Okay. Dam building on the Columbia, which began in 1939 with Grand Coulee, was part of the broader federal effort to irrigate the arid West, to provide reliable water and electricity, and consistent jobs for rural Westerners beginning in the mid-19th century and continuing for about 100 years. The two that we're going to be looking at the most were really Lower Granite and these three here. We'll talk a little bit about Dworshak. Lower Granite and Dworshak are the closest to home of the major dams for us. Dam building peaked between the 1960s to 1980s. There are currently over 90,000 dams in the United States, half as much as China. More than half of these dams are privately owned. Approximately 4% or 6,000 of these dams are federally owned and managed. This includes the four Lower Snake Rivers and, four Lower Snake River dams and Dworshak Dam. These dams were constructed by the Army Corps of Engineers after the Lower Snake River project was authorized by Congress in 1945. Between 45 and 75, the Reclamation Bureau and Army Corps of Engineers built more than 150 dams on the Columbia, Missouri, and Colorado River basins. The express purpose of the four Lower Snake dams was to allow for navigation to produce hydroelectric power. When completed, these projects would consist of dams, operational facilities, and a system of locks which would provide a navigable waterway to Lewiston, Idaho, making this the farthest inland seaport in the western U.S. The four locks and dams allow for barge transportation by raising and lowering barges between different pools along the river. These dams and the slack water lakes behind them run 140 river miles from Pasco to Lewiston. Construction began in 1956 with Ice Harbor and finished with Lower Granite in 1976. Lower Granite is the closest of these to the Palouse. Dworshak Dam, which separates the North Fork Clearwater from the main stem Clearwater, was completed in 1974. And I'll hint at Dworshak. I didn't have time to include much about it in this talk, but it might come up in the Q&A. It was primarily produced or built for flood control, hydroelectric power, and recreation. In addition to lock and dam construction, to become navigable, the Snake River was dredged to a depth of 14 feet, 5 feet deeper than the Mississippi. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was congressionally authorized to maintain a 14-foot deep by 250-feet wide navigation channel along the Columbia Snake River system. As presence of the dams speeds up sedimentation, dredging must be a regular occurring event to continue to allow barge traffic. And dredging's taken place about once every 7 years. The last time major dredging in Lewiston was in 2023. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers owns and operates the four Lower Snake River dams, all of which are, according to the Walla Walla District, multiple-use facilities that provide navigation for barge traffic, hydropower used as part of local energy transmission, recreation, and fish and wildlife conservation benefits. So let's talk about a few of those benefits. Just like the beaver dams provide benefits to the ecosystem it inhabits, these dams provide benefits, though not many positive ecological ones. Remember, people are a hyper-keystone species. The beaver's economic and ecological systems are one and the same, We've separated ours, and I'll let the economists in the room weigh in on that and flesh that out for us here when I'm done. Here are the major economic benefits of the lower four Snake River dams. Number one is energy production. According to a Bonneville Power Administration analysis, the four lower Snake River dams produce 933 megawatts of power annually. 1 megawatt is enough to run about 800 homes. This is 6.6% of the total 14,000 megawatts generated by Columbia River dams. Second major benefit, and this is the biggest one, transportation, and number two and three go together. Transportation of goods to port, around 2.5 to 3 million tons annually, leave Lewiston and head to Portland via barge. In 2023, for example, 3.4 million tons of goods moved through the Ice Harbor Dam. 85% of that, let me catch up with myself here, there's Lower Granite. And that's millions of tons annually from 1999 to 2023. You can see a little bit of a decline over the last 20 years. That's mostly wheat. So agricultural products, wood products, fertilizer, then all other cargo, including computer components, video games, all kinds of stuff. In small quantity goes on those barges. So a pretty big volume. How much does it save to send via barge? It saves a ton to send via barge. This is the strongest point and the hardest thing to overcome if we were to remove or breach the four lower Snake River dams. To barge wheat costs 30 to 45 cents per bushel compared to 50 to 75 cents per bushel via rail. Each barge can carry 3,600 tons of grain. One rail car can carry 100 tons. And one semi-truck, 30 tons. Employment, the inland water freight employed a whopping 248 people in all of Washington State in 2017, so not a huge employer. Irrigation, 13% of farmland within 5 miles of the Lower Snake use river water. This is considered a relatively small use. And then also benefits of lake fishing and boating and associated activities. I don't have quantification for that one. So those are the major economic benefits of the dams. And I will say, the dams, the slack water is great for a lot of fish species, but not fish species from here. So if you love bass fishing in the south, now you can just stay on the Columbia and go bass fishing. We have a 1,000-square-mile bass fishing lake now that's right down the street. So you could consider that a benefit. Okay. This is a sockeye salmon, beautiful creature. Before the construction of the four lower Snake River dams, there were three major salmon runs on the Snake River, totaling about 120,000 Chinook salmon, about 150,000 sockeye salmon. And just to put that in perspective, that's number of fish running upstream to spawn. The total number of salmon was actually 2 to 4 million resident salmon in the area. That's just how large the runs were. And there were steelhead and coho salmon as well. These fish spawned in one of the Snake's three major tributaries, the Salmon, the Grand Ronde, or the Clearwater, and they still do today. The majority of the sockeyes, which is this guy here, which in my mind the most beautiful of the salmonids, made it home from the sea and returned all the way to the iconic Redfish Lake in the Sawtooth, swimming over 900 miles to do so. The most poignant and painful story regarding the demise of wild salmon is the tale of Lonesome Larry. Yep, that was his name. Lonesome Larry was the sole sockeye to return to Redfish Lake in 1992. Not kidding. One sockeye salmon returned to Redfish Lake, so named because it looked like that previously. This is Iliamna Lake. This isn't Redfish Lake. Lonesome Larry. So Lonesome Larry, he's contributed greatly since then. So 23 sockeye salmon returned to Redfish Lake in the 90s. That's a decade. Larry's sperm was collected and used to fertilize several thousand eggs from female sockeyes that returned in that same decade. According to Blaine Hardin, it is definitive a river lost the life and death of the Columbia. Then Idaho Governor Cecil Andrus, a devoted fisherman, had Larry stuffed, mounted, and displayed for visitors as a symbol of how eight lumps of concrete have ruined his state's heritage. He was a Republican. politics change? All right. All right, going to continue to be pessimistic here for a little bit, and eventually I'll be optimistic, okay? Snake River coho were declared extinct in 1984. The construction of the Lewiston Dam in 1927 is implicated as the primary cause of their decline. That dam was removed in 1973. Since the Snake River dams were finished in 1976, return rates for the salmon to Lower Granite Lock and Dam, the uppermost dam, have consistently fallen below 2%. That means of smolt, little fish, going to sea, the number that mature and make it back upstream to spawn is 2% of that total that left. That's a big percentage compared to some of the numbers you're going to hear in a minute. Biologists recommend 2-6% return rate is the minimum rate that will sustain a wild salmon population. A couple of data points here. This is Wild River or Wild Snake River sockeye. So significant population declines. Wild Snake River steelhead. And Wild Snake River spring and summer chinook. So it's pretty daunting numbers here, daunting trend. Okay. Two quick data points on salmon returns to keep perspective. For the spawning year 2023, 13,631 steelhead were estimated to have crossed Lower Dammit. Lower Granite. Wow, that's an actual Freudian slip. That was significant. Excuse my language. This translates to 13% of the proposed escapement goal of 104,000 wild steelhead. In 2024, this is last year, 7,800 sockeye crossed Ice Harbor Dam and 44 returned to Redfish Lake of that 7,800. Given these results, Snake River sockeye were listed as endangered in 1991, Snake River spring and summer and fall chinook as threatened in 92, and Snake River steelhead as threatened in 1997. Construction of Dworshak Dam in 1972 completely eliminated the migration of steelhead and salmon to spawning grounds on the North Fork Clearwater by blocking the river and not allowing passage. So with that exception, Dworshak, it's important to understand how dams actually kill salmon. There are ways to get around these dams. There are fist passages that are built for them to pass in both directions. So why can they not handle slack water in this magnitude? The water behind the four lower Snake River dams averages 1 mile per hour flow. The slack water completely changes the ecology of the river. The creation of the thousands of acres of slack water on the lower Snake have led to the following indirect impacts on salmon and steelhead. Number one, there are multiple native and introduced predator fish species that thrive in warm slack water. These include smallmouth bass, northern pike minnow, walleye, and trout. According to the Northwest Power and Conservation Council, northern pike minnow eat millions of smolts, fish 1 to 3 years old, every year in the Columbia River system. Number two, avian predators find it easy hunting in the slackwater Columbia as well. In particular, Caspian terns and double-crested cormorants. According to a 2020 report by bird researchers from Oregon State, the cumulative effects of avian predation on smolt accounted for more than 50% of all upper Columbia steelhead smolt losses during their out-migration. So that's a 12-year study. So birds are eating 50% of the baby fish swimming to sea. It's a shocking finding. Slack water warms rapidly and when in large quantities retains heat effectively. The warmer the water, the less able it is to hold dissolved oxygen. Salmon are among the greediest in regards to oxygen. 68 degrees Fahrenheit is considered the threshold for steelhead and salmon. There is a bit of variation between species and individuals, but this is a rule of thumb. When temperatures exceed 68 Fahrenheit for significant periods of time during migration, lots of die-offs can occur. In the summer and fall of 2024, Ice Harbor, Lower Monumental, and Little Goose all registered 40 days above 68. Lower Granite registered 18 days above 68. But 68 is really a conservative threshold. Chinook salmon require 58 degrees Fahrenheit or lower for spawning. Adult steelhead require 64.4 or lower for migration. And so that's a bit less than the 68 threshold. Disease, number four, on how these dams kill salmon. Salmonids already stressed by high water temps are less able to deal with a second stressor, such as a pathogen. For example, warmer temperatures often increase the infection rate or virulence of fish pathogens and lessen the ability of a fish to withstand disease. Many important salmonid diseases become virulent right around 60 degrees Fahrenheit. You might be doing the math and realize that something's a bit fishy. If only this many wild salmon and steelhead are returning to the Snake and Clear waters annually, a few thousand, then how are gulls and smallmouth bass getting so fat on smolt for breakfast? Short answer, we are subsidizing the food web. We'll come right back to this in a second. To the economics here for a little bit. From an economic perspective, nature can be seen as a portfolio of assets that were designed to meet our every physical need and many of our spiritual needs. To think of creation as simply a ledger of liabilities and assets is, of course, a narrow view of God's general revelation to man. The cycles and systems created by God to govern and provide for life on earth are fully integrated at all scales, from molecules to major ocean currents. Because of creation's complexity, an economic framework can serve as a helpful tool to understand the value of biodiversity in intact ecosystems, however. There we go. Still have life. Okay. There's a little bit of the temperature regimes currently to the left, and then the temperature regimes projected upon dam breaching or dam removal. Okay. Excuse me. More than $9 billion has been spent over the last four decades on salmon and steelhead restoration efforts on the Columbia River by federal and state agencies, along with additional actions by local governments and non-governmental actors. A few of these bullet points: construction of the four lower Snake River dams in today's dollars cost $775 million. An annual $227 million is the cost of maintaining and operating the lower Snake River dams. $2.6 million was the average cost of maintaining the Clearwater Fish Hatchery. Construction of Dworshak Dam was $327 million in today's dollars. The cost of maintaining Dworshak National Fish Hatchery is estimated $1.5 to $2 million annually. They must be dredged every 7 or so years. That's about $5 to $10 million per dredging event. And hot off the press this week, the Inflation Reduction Act just gave native tribes in the Northwest $240 million for tribal hatchery improvement. And so the primary ecological subsidy for salmon is the construction and maintenance and running of fish hatcheries. Several acts of Congress have attempted to compensate for habitat loss associated with these dams being built, hence the production of the fish hatchery system. The 1938 Mitchell Act, the 1980 Pacific Northwest Electric Power Planning and Conservation Act, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Lower Snake River Compensation Plan of 76 all contributed to this. These plans and others paved the way for hatcheries to be built to supplement low fish numbers. They also provided money to make improvements to dams, such as adding fish ladders, etc. The Dworshak National Fish Hatchery was built in 1969 to mitigate for the loss of steelhead trout in the North Fork Clearwater and its tributaries as a result of the construction of Dworshak Dam. Today, there are about 200 salmon hatchery programs in the Columbia River Basin, and 80% of the salmon and steelhead that return as adults were hatched and reared in hatcheries. To give you a sense for how much of a failure fish hatcheries on the Columbia have been, remember that fishy math from earlier? If only this many wild salmon return, how are there millions of smolt to feed the gulls and smallmouth bass? The average smolt to adult ratio, which is the measure of how many smolt released at the hatchery return as adults to the hatchery, from 2000 to 2018 at the Clearwater National Hatchery was 0.28%. Not 28%, 0.28%. During the same time, 3.8 million smolt were produced, 0.28% of 3.8 million is 10,640 salmon. Enough fish to keep some folks employed, but a really expensive way to feed Caspian terns and double-crested cormorants. It will cost us a lot of money to breach the four lower Snake River dams. It will cost us a lot of money to restore the rail system where it has fallen into disrepair. It will cost us more per bushel to ship grain. In 2021, Republican Idaho Congressman Mike Simpson submitted his Northwestern Transition Plan, in which he proposed breaching, this is a Republican congressman in Idaho, he proposed breaching the earth and berm portions of the dams for the purpose of restoring salmon and steelhead runs. His plan cost $34 billion. Jay Inslee, outgoing governor this week, proposed a plan that cost between $10 to $27 billion. Francis Schaeffer, in his book, Pollution and the Death of Man, A Christian View of Ecology, argues that Christians should assume tending the earth will cost us more time and more money than secularists. It will take time for the Snake and Clearwater rivers to recover. Thankfully, we've just received increasingly robust data sets from several major dams that were removed in the Northwest. The Klamath just finished this past year in California, Oregon, and the Elwha River was restored to free-flowing state in 2014. The fish will return, but it could take several years or even a decade. Al Wright, former Pacific Northwest, there we go. Al Wright, former Pacific Northwest Utilities Conference committee member, is quoted as saying, "We took a pristine river and we turned it into a working river, a machine, and it is a damn fine machine." We could be content with that reality, or we can envision something better, as Schaeffer did when he said, "The Christian who believes the Bible should be the man who, with God's help and in the power of the Holy Spirit, is treating nature now in the direction of the way nature will be when Christ returns." God's calling to the Christian now and to the Christian community in the area of nature is that we should exhibit a substantial healing here and now. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this presentation from the George Buchanan Forum Conference. We have many more that you can check out at our website at tgbf.org. You can also find us on YouTube or on your favorite podcasting platform. In true free market fashion, we're entirely crowdfunded by the generous support of people like you. If you'd like to help our work, you can set up one-time or recurring donations at tgbf.org. The best way for others to hear about us is from their friends. So please consider liking, subscribing, and sharing our material. We greatly appreciate it.